The Tom Woods Show, episode 2161.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Well, today we're talking about communism. And what I'm doing today is sharing material from my Ron Paul curriculum government course. And in that course, I have a unit on comparative systems. And so one of the systems I talk about is communism. I've also got fascism and social democracy and monarchy and all these different sorts of systems. But the system I'm sharing with you today is communism. And what I've actually done is I've taken two lessons on communism and mushed them together. But what I've done is I've removed the first few minutes of each one, because the first few minutes of each one is a review from the previous one. So the first communism lesson will be a review from the previous day when I talked about Marxism. And the second communism lesson would have a review of the first communism. You don't need those reviews because you're listening to them in one sitting all at once. And we've done our best to sort of merge them together as one unit. So that week in the Ron Paul curriculum, I do two lessons on Marxism, two lessons on communism, and then a weekly review. So they're getting a pretty good background on stuff like this. Now, this course is intended for high schoolers, but you are an adult, I know, listening to this show, and you are not going to feel talked down to. I absolutely promise. I promise you will get something out of this material. If you would like this course, there are multiple ways to get it. TomWoodsHomeschool.com. You can get it through RonPaulHomeschool.com if you join the entire curriculum, and then you're selecting the courses. You can select Government 1B, which is what this one is. But if you don't want to join the entire curriculum, you just want this one course, then TomWoodsHomeschool.com is a way to do it. You can also get it at certain membership levels of supportinglisteners.com if you support the Tom Woods Show. So there are multiple ways to get this course. I'm going to link them all or make them all available to you at TomWoods.com/2161. So having said that, I hope you enjoy this material. Here we go. All right, we're going to look at a little bit of the history of Soviet Russia. And we're going to do that because this is how we see the instantiation, the implementation of Marxism in an actual society. It's kind of like what we did with fascism. We looked at the principles of fascism, and then we tried to observe them in action when we got to Italy and Germany. So we're going to do the same thing with Russia. And in the same way, we're going to see that this is not a system that is super-duper committed to individual rights and the values of the classical liberal or libertarian tradition at all. It is always a case of the collective trumping the individual. The public interest trumps the private interest all over again. All right, so let's take a look now at the case of Russia. And we'll begin with a man I want to familiarize you with, and that's Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, V.I. Lenin, who becomes the first communist leader of Russia, Soviet Russia, becomes a Soviet Union. That takes place in 1917. But before that, he has an important book in 1902 called What is to be Done? And the theme that I want to extract for you from that book is as follows. According to Lenin, the proletariat, the working class, left to itself, will never rise up in revolution. All they'll do is engage in trade unionism. In other words, they'll say, boy, we have terrible working conditions, so we'll go join a labor union. And from the communist point of view, a labor union, I mean, give me a break. We want to overthrow the whole system, not make you comfortable in the present system. So labor unionism, are you kidding me? That's as far as they'll go. So Lenin is impatient with that. We got to give them a push. We got to help give them a push. Now, remember, what did Marx say? Marx said, communism is coming whether you like it or not. It's going to unfold with the inevitability of a law of history. But according to Lenin, that's not quite true. And so this is why we sometimes hear the term Marxism-Leninism, because Lenin is going to develop the ideas of Marx and add his own flavor and his own contributions. And one of them is this idea that we need what he calls a vanguard of the proletariat, a class of professional revolutionaries to agitate among them, to educate them, to help them see the world more clearly. Marx never envisioned such a thing, that there would be a class of professional revolutionaries who would do this for a living. He thought that revolutionary consciousness would emerge spontaneously among the workers without any outside help. Lenin is going to dispute this. Now, of course, if you're going to have a class of professional revolutionaries, they're going to have to be intellectuals, people who think all day. People who do physical labor would have no time for this.
And it's interesting that only one worker ever sat on the board of Lenin's party, and he turned out to be a police spy. Lenin is going to raise money for his revolutionaries through bank robberies and similar means. Gives you an indication of the sort of person you're dealing with here. During World War I in Russia, World War I, of course, is from 1914 to 1918. World War I was very, very difficult for Russia. They were dramatically and vastly unprepared for the war. They were sending the men out to battle. 25% of them were sent out with no weapons. And they were instructed that when you see your dead colleagues on the ground, pick up their weapons, take them. Well, this doesn't exactly do wonders for morale, obviously. So there were tremendous sacrifices that the public was making to support the war effort. And the peasants in particular in the countryside were under tremendous pressure. Millions of them were conscripted into the armed forces. The remainder had enormous demands for food placed upon them. There were compulsory purchases of food made by the government. That is to say, you're forced to sell to us on these terms. There were rising food prices, which led to conflict between the city and the countryside. The city wants the food. The countryside wants reasonable prices reflecting current conditions. And the Bolsheviks exploited all this. The Bolsheviks were Lenin's party. The Bolsheviks were the more, let's say, militant Marxist group. And it's the Bolsheviks who are going to take power in 1917. They're going to exploit this. They're going to make promises to everybody. They make promises to the peasants that, don't worry, you won't have to endure conditions like these if we take power. But of course, when the Bolsheviks take power, they treat the peasants even worse than the current government did. That's always the case. The key event, or a key event in 1917, that's going to really drive the Tsar from his position, going to lead him to abdicate. The Tsar, of course, is the monarch in Russia, is a mutiny in the Petrograd military garrison. The peasant draftees there felt like they should have been exempt from military duty. And what's more, when unruly crowds presented themselves, the soldiers in the Petrograd garrison refused to fire on the crowds and instead turned the guns around. The Tsar, Nicholas II, was urged to abdicate, that is to give up his position in the government, to defuse the situation. And for all his faults, Nicholas appears to have been a reasonably patriotic person. And when convinced that this was the best thing to do for Russia, he did indeed step down. Now, the new government was not the government run by the communists. That's not till later in 1917. The new government right now that replaced the Tsar is not the communists, but something called the Provisional Government. And the Provisional Government was led by a guy named Alexander Kerensky. And they insist on continuing the war. Well, this is, you're just practically handing things to the Bolsheviks now. The war is extremely unpopular. The Provisional Government could have really solidified its position by withdrawing Russia from the war. It would have become instantly popular. But it becomes very unpopular when people learn that the Provisional Government intends to carry on the war. And that leaves the Bolsheviks able to exploit the war's unpopularity. The Provisional Government promises elections to a constituent assembly, that there will be a new legislative assembly in Russia, and you will all be able to vote for representatives in it. Well, they keep putting off the vote and putting it off and putting it off and not holding it. And so the Bolsheviks accuse the Provisional Government of actually having no intention of holding the elections. They say, they're just making these promises to you, but they don't actually intend to make good on those promises. What's more, the Bolsheviks promised self-determination to the various nationalities in Russia. Russia ruled over a vast and diverse array of peoples, and the Bolsheviks were promising these peoples that you'll get your own country if we get in charge. So they're making promises to the nationalities. They're making promises to people who favor the constituent assembly. They're making promises to the peasants. They're making whatever promises are necessary. And in case after case, it's clear they have absolutely no intention of carrying out those promises, making good on those promises. And in fact, typically they intend to do exactly the opposite of what they promise. Meanwhile, Alexander Kerensky, the head of the Provisional Government, tries to get the peasants to hand over obviously unreasonable amounts of food, and the Provisional Government loses control in the countryside. There's just an open revolt against them for this. Then, in a 1-2 punch, Kerensky loses the support of the army. after accusing General Kornilov of planning a military takeover. This apparently was a false accusation. But now Kerensky and the provisional government lose control of the army, and they needed the support of the army in case the Bolsheviks should try to take over, which indeed they had tried to do in July of that year. So if they try to take over again, Kerensky's not going to have the support of the army. And as a matter of fact, now to try to balance things out, he releases some Bolsheviks from prison and arms them against Kornilov. Well, to make a long story short, the Bolsheviks do well in elections to the various Soviets, which were workers' councils, and finally conclude that now is the time to strike. And by the time you get to November 7th, the Bolsheviks take over all the strategic points in the capital. Now, incidentally, you may hear this referred to as the October Revolution. So you may wonder why it's taking place November 7th. That just has to do with the fact that there was a difference between the Western and Eastern calendars. So the Russian calendar was slightly different from the Western one. And so sometimes you'll see we'll use the Western calendar, call it November, and they were using another calendar calling it October. Just in case you're wondering, that's the reason for that. So the Bolsheviks are going to take over with very little violence. Now that the Bolsheviks had really solidified their position in the various workers' councils called Soviets, they made their slogan, all power to the Soviets. And so this sounded like an appeal to grassroots democracy. Now, the Bolsheviks were such a minority. I mean, it's 18,000 people, maybe? I mean, very, very small in a country of many tens of millions of people. So how did this all happen? Well, one explanation is that the other socialist parties were absolutely sure that if the Bolsheviks took over and imposed a dictatorship on the country, there's no way that was going to last. Eventually, they'd have to welcome in other socialist parties into a coalition government. So let's just wait for that to happen. Why launch a civil war? Why impose that type of suffering on the country? But it's important to realize that communism did not come to Russia through some kind of popular uprising on the part of the people. It was a tiny, well-organized minority. And it was imposed by that minority using democratic-sounding slogans. I want to read to you a passage from an expert on the Soviet Union, Professor Richard Pipes, whom I knew a little bit when I was an undergrad. And he writes this. You just got to listen to this passage. I love this. He says, viewing the Bolsheviks' power seizure from the perspective of history, one can only marvel at their audacity. None of the leading Bolsheviks had experience in administering anything, and yet they were about to assume responsibility for governing the world's largest country. Nor, lacking business experience, did they shy from promptly nationalizing and hence assuming responsibility for managing the world's fifth largest economy. They saw in the overwhelming majority of Russia's citizens, the bourgeoisie and the landowners as a matter of principle, and most of the peasantry and intelligentsia as a matter of fact, class enemies of the industrial workers whom they claimed to represent. These workers constituted a small proportion of Russia's population, at best 1 or 2%, and of this minority, only a minuscule number followed the Bolsheviks. On the eve of the November coup, only 5.3% of industrial workers belonged to the Bolshevik Party. This meant that the new regime had no alternative but to turn into a dictatorship not of the proletariat, but over the proletariat and all the other classes. The dictatorship, which in time evolved into a totalitarian regime, was thus necessitated by the very nature of the Bolshevik takeover. As long as they wanted to stay in power, the communists had to rule despotically and violently. They could never afford to relax their authority. The principle held true of every communist regime that followed. By the way, if you have not heard that word totalitarian before, it refers to a type of system in which the government has total control in every nook and cranny of society. It's not just like your garden variety dictatorship, where as long as you stay out of the dictator's way, you can more or less live your life unharmed. A totalitarian regime wants not only your outward acceptance, but wants your inward acceptance. I mean, it really wants to invade your very soul, wants to be in every nook and cranny, wants to dominate the religious life, the artistic life, the intellectual life, and put all these things in the service of the regime. Lenin said that dictatorship, including that of the proletariat, was, quote, power that is limited by nothing, by no laws, that is restrained by absolutely no rules, that rests directly on coercion. Elections were finally held to the Constituent Assembly. Remember those elections that the provisional government had promised and the Bolsheviks mocked them, claiming you'd have no intention of holding these elections? Well, the Bolsheviks held the elections. The Bolsheviks got 24% of the vote, so they allowed the Constituent Assembly to meet for one day, and then they closed it forever. There you go. The key governing body in the government established by Lenin was something called the Council of People's Commissars. It consisted entirely of Bolsheviks, and it simply carried out the orders of the Bolshevik Party. Lenin right away made an unfavorable peace with the Germans. And when I say unfavorable, I mean unfavorable to Russia. He gave away enormous amounts of territory to the Germans as the price for just being allowed to get out of the war. He just wanted to spend his time consolidating his power. He was against the war to start with, and he certainly didn't want to waste resources fighting a war against Germany that he considered totally irrelevant to what he was trying to do. So he wanted to get out of that war at all costs, so he did that. Meanwhile, the theory of Marxism and communism fails them again and again. Time and again, the theory fails to predict what actually happens, but they cannot admit that they were wrong. This is scientific socialism, comrade. We're not wrong. Well, let's look at just a couple quick areas where they were wrong. They're wrong about the state. Marx's view of the state was that the state is the instrument by which one class oppresses another. The state is just an instrument. It doesn't have any interests of its own. It is the instrument that the ruling class uses to oppress everybody else. But the Soviet state, it became obvious, had interests of its own. The people who were in the state had interests of their own that they wanted to pursue. Now, how they could have failed to see this, or how they could have failed to see that there would be a large bureaucratic structure established when the government has taken over all industry, takes over education, transportation, retail, and wholesale trade. Yeah, you're going to have a giant, monstrous bureaucracy of a sort that Marx never envisioned, never expected such a thing, or that this bureaucracy would operate according to its own interests. This trend is going to become extremely obvious under Joseph Stalin, who is appointed by Lenin as General Secretary of the Communist Party. He's going to build up a cadre of people loyal to him who will get all kinds of special privileges. The government officials will get all kinds of special privileges because of their attachment to the government. This group is known as the Nomenklatura, and they're going to get special food that nobody else gets, hospitals that nobody else gets access to, resorts that nobody else has access to, even cemeteries that nobody else has access to. So what does this have to do with implementing communism? This is simply the state having interests of its own and pursuing those interests. Whatever happened to equality among all men and all this stuff? Yeah, there's no equality. Now it's the ruling class is the communists, and we're going to get all the goodies. Socialism was supposed to be more efficient than capitalism. It was supposed to be able to produce more stuff. They also believe that the economy should be able to be run without money. Money is just a creature of capitalism. They try to run an economy without money. And of course, it's a complete disaster. They have no idea how to manage any of the factories. They're hopelessly mismanaged. The underground economy grows larger than the official one. In other words, where people are illegally exchanging things with each other. They're more often illegally exchanging things than they are exchanging things out in the open because everything is such a disaster in the official sector of the economy. Meanwhile, hyperinflation hits. Prices rise 100 million times between 1917 and 1923. They rise by 100 million times. Large-scale industrial production falls dramatically. In 1920, it's only 18% of what it had been in 1913. Coal output dropped to 27% of what it had been. Iron to a pathetic 2.4%. The number of employed industrial workers in 1921 was less than half the level it had been at in 1918. The standard of living fell by two-thirds. One communist observer called it a disaster unparalleled in the history of mankind. None of this was supposed to have happened. None of this was supposed to have happened. What was Lenin's response to this? Well, maybe we made some mistakes, or maybe our theory is, you know, half-baked, or maybe we're idiots, or maybe we bit off more than we could chew. No. His response was the firing squad. That's the typical communist response. Isaac Steinberg, who was the communist commissar of justice, was observing how Lenin used the firing squad and said, "Why do we bother with a commissariat of justice? Let's call it the Commissariat for Social Extermination and be done with it." And according to Steinberg, Lenin's face suddenly brightened and he replied, "Well put, that's exactly what it should be. But we can't say that." And incidentally, the study of law and the practice of law was totally revolutionized immediately under Lenin. But we don't need people who have studied law. We don't need people who know about legal precedent and legal procedure. That's all stupid capitalist nonsense. That's all out the window. No, all we need are people who have a communist sense of justice. All we need are people with a communist understanding who can just implement that on a case-by-case basis. Whatever you think communism requires in a particular instance, that's the decision that you should make. So it becomes a complete cuckoo house. Now, Lenin faces a major economic problem in the form of a drop in food production, because what had been going on during the war was that the peasants were tired of all these compulsory purchases, so they would just plant less, so there'd be less for the government to take from them. Well, so what's Lenin going to do about this? The peasants not planting enough, and there not being enough food for the cities, and et cetera. Well, the Bolsheviks hated the peasants. They considered the peasants to be the class enemies of the workers. The workers are the ones the Bolsheviks pretend to care about. But the workers themselves had come from the villages, almost all of them, and almost all of them maintained close ties with the villages. But the Bolsheviks hated the peasants anyway. They wanted to seize food for the Red Army, for their army, and they wanted to get a foothold in the countryside. But a Bolshevik influence really hadn't touched the countryside at this time. So they sent armed detachments to the countryside. They urged peasants to report people who were hoarding food. And the result? Civil war in the countryside. Vladimir Brovkin, who was my own professor of 20th century Russia when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, he's a former professor at Harvard, said that the real civil war in Russia was against the Greens. When I talk about this period of history at greater length in Western Civilization too, I'll talk about the Russian Civil War, which is also raging at this time between the Russian people who were loyal to the Tsar and people who were loyal to the communists. The people loyal to the Tsar were known as the Whites. And most textbooks going over this material will say that was the Civil War between the Whites and the Reds, the loyalists of the Tsar and the communists. But no, as Brovkin correctly showed, the real Civil War is between the Reds and the Greens, the communists and the peasants. That was the real Civil War. So the peasants continued to reduce the acreage on which they planted so that the Bolsheviks would have less surplus to grab from them. Harvests declined sharply. Peasant rebellions are everywhere. There are strikes in the cities over food shortages. There's general unrest. Lenin tries to use the military, including poison gas, by the way, to crush this. But he knew this wouldn't be enough, and so he actually retreats a bit. And you get in 1921 something called the New Economic Policy, sometimes just called NEP, announced. And this is sometimes referred to as a case of two steps forward and one step back, meaning that we've taken two steps forward toward communism, and the new economic policy represents a temporary step back, but we're still ahead of where we were. We've still implemented a lot of communism, but he had no choice. With complete chaos everywhere, he had to declare that there wouldn't be any more grabbing of food by government goons. He said that peasants will pay a tax in kind, that is not in money, but in physical goods. And then they'll be allowed to sell their goods in the open market. And he allowed a limited amount of private business to operate. So on a small scale, some small businesses could operate without the government's direct supervision. But all these concessions were too late to prevent a horrifying famine, the worst ever suffered by any European country up to that point. It was triggered by a drought, but in a normal country, a drought does not lead to 5.2 million lives lost. By 1922, Lenin was frustrated. His health was failing. He ordered hundreds of opposition scholars, economists, and philosophers exiled without explanation. During the famine, he urged the confiscation of Russian Orthodox church valuables. And what he wanted to do was take these church valuables, melt them down, and sell them for money. And he's claiming that, see, the churches are so cold-hearted. Everybody's starving, and they have these valuables. And if only we could take these chalices and all these sacred things and melt them down, we could feed everybody. He did this also to the Catholic Church in Russia, which was, of course, much, much smaller than the Orthodox Church. And when they did grab these valuables and melt them down, by the way, he didn't use the money to feed the public. I assume you're cynical enough to know that that was never his intention. He used it to buy weapons from the Germans, actually. The Germans were supposed to be their enemies. He used it to buy weapons from the Germans. That was where the money went. And incidentally, it's obvious that he also wanted to crush the churches by doing this. That was part of his goal. And you can see that in the fact that at the time, the Pope was Pope Benedict XV. And Benedict XV sent a letter to Lenin saying, look, if you want, you need money for famine relief, we'll just send you the money. Give us an estimate of what the valuables are worth, and we'll send you a check for that equivalent amount. But please don't melt down sacred vessels. Well, Lenin doesn't want it that way. He wants to melt down the sacred vessels because that humiliates the church, which, of course, the churches were opponents of communism all through the 20th century. When fashionable opinion looked the other way at communist crimes or made excuses for communism or progressive journalists would go to Russia and say how wonderful it all was, the churches were always the opponents, and he wanted to crush them. So he doesn't want some deal with the Pope. He wants to crush them. So this is really what it's come to by the end of Lenin's life.
All right, before I go on, let me remind you about an app that's going to make your life way better, that's going to make you well-informed in a short period of time. Sounds kind of like the Tom Woods Show a little bit, doesn't it? But I'm talking about Blinkist, which takes all kinds of nonfiction categories of books and slims those books down for you to just 15 minutes of listening or reading. So you get all the key points, no fluff. I've told you about the old classics they have, like Machiavelli's The Prince and Seneca on Stoicism, but of course also a ton of modern books. For example, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. That is perfect for our audience. And then you'll even find on Blinkist Murray Rothbard's book, For a New Liberty. And that's one of the early libertarian books I read that helped put things together for me, that helped me realize that in one area after another, there was a freedom-based answer to what ails us. It's the kind of thing that changes your life when you read it. And that's the kind of title you'll find many of at Blinkist. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods.
Lenin dies in 1923 and no provision has been made for his replacement. You can see Lenin there in this photograph. That's him on the left, and that's Joseph Stalin on the right. Stalin, you'll recall, had been appointed General Secretary of the Communist Party by Lenin. And in the ensuing years, he is going to come to possess absolute power. His actual name was Djigashvili, not Stalin. He changed his last name to Stalin, which means man of steel, if you can keep a straight face for that. Now, with two colleagues, Kamenev and Zinoviev, Stalin gets rid of Leon Trotsky, who was a communist rival of his. Trotsky is eventually going to be exiled. He's going to live some of the rest of his life in Mexico, and in 1940, a pickaxe is going to be found in his head. So he had been done away with by that point. But he's gotten rid of, in terms of being a rival to Stalin, in the 1920s. But then after Stalin uses Kamenev and Zinoviev to help him rid himself of Trotsky, he then removes Kamenev and Zinoviev. He gets them removed from the Politburo. The Politburo was central to the functioning of the Soviet government. In 1929, Stalin is going to announce the 5-year plan. This is a plan for the rapid industrialization of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union had been very, very largely a rural society, a society based on agriculture. And he wanted to change that, to make the Soviet Union a great power very, very quickly. The 5-year plan, of course, is the exact opposite of a free market economy, which operates according to no plan. It operates, well, I should say a free market economy is the sum total of all the individual plans of all the individual members of society working harmoniously together. The 5-year plan is imposed from the top. It's imposed by the government on the society, and you've got to be fit into whatever your place is going to be in the 5-year plan. So this is a plan for rapid industrialization, and it's also a plan, I mean, part of the reason for rapid industrialization, and you won't see this mentioned in a lot of textbooks, but it's absolutely true. Richard Pipes of Harvard attests to this, that Stalin was obsessed with the idea that the capitalist countries were out to get him. The capitalist countries wanted nothing more than to strangle communism in its cradle. And he thought that the way to protect the Soviet Union against such a threat was to industrialize rapidly. so that the society would become wealthy and also would be able to produce the type of military equipment necessary to make themselves into a formidable enough foe that the capitalist countries would think twice before causing any trouble to the communists. Now, the claim was that the standard of living of the general population would improve thanks to the five-year plan and thanks to industrialization. But this turned out not to be the case. In fact, very much the opposite took place. In 1933, for example, workers' real earnings, and when we use the word real here, we mean not real as opposed to unreal or fake, but real in the sense of purchasing power. So, for example, you hear your grandparents say, in my day, I could get an ice cream cone for 25 cents. Whereas today, for 25 cents, you can't get anything. Well, when we talk about 25 cents today and 25 cents 100 years ago, we're talking about the same nominal amount of money, 25 cents. But what we're really interested in is what can 25 cents buy? So when we're talking about real income, if you were earning 25 cents 100 years ago and you lived to be 100 years old, and now all of a sudden you look and you find you're still earning only 25 cents, your nominal income would be the same, 25 cents, but your real income would be way lower because 25 cents today can't buy you very much. So the point is, anytime I use this term real, real earnings, real income, I mean income in terms of what it can purchase. I'm not saying that people used to earn $100, now they're earning $10. I'm saying that people used to be able to buy this much stuff with their income. And now they can buy only this much stuff with their income. So we adjust for inflation when we're talking about real earnings. And so in 1933, the workers' real earnings were down to only 10% of what they had been 7 years earlier. Now imagine that in 7 years' time, you find that your income can buy you only 1/10 of what it used to. Who cares what the dollar amount of your income is? The point is the real value of your income is such that it can acquire for you only 1/10 of what it used to be able to acquire for you. How is Stalin paying for industrialization? How is he financing it? He's financing it in large part by paying the workers very little. And that helps to account for the catastrophic decline in their living standards. So yes, it's true. There's no private business firm that can oppress workers anymore. Now the workers all work for the government. There's just one big firm. And guess what? It's going to pay you 10% of what you used to get. There's the workers' paradise they're all living in. Alex Nov is a specialist on the Soviet economy who wrote, quote, 1933 was the culmination of the most precipitous peacetime decline in living standards known in recorded history. So communism, here we are at 1933. It's been in power for maybe 16 years. It's been one unspeakable catastrophe after another. This idea of an economy based on central planning by a group of government employees, absolute catastrophe. The exact opposite of the liberal, classical liberal libertarian ideas that we've been talking about in a good chunk of this course. Now, also, in order to support all the workers in the cities who are helping to bring about industrialization, Stalin is going to need food at cheap prices for those workers. And so Stalin is going to want to engage in the collectivization of agriculture. And that means that private property in land will be abolished, that it's not enough that all of industry has been taken over. Now all the agricultural land has to be taken over as well. And in particular, the kulaks are going to be punished severely. The kulaks are the more well-to-do peasants. They're going to be punished. They're going to be singled out as the class enemy. Their property is going to be taken. They're going to be sent to Siberia or to a labor camp. But as time goes on, the discrimination between kulaks and just ordinary peasants was not being made very carefully. And it became clear that anybody who just resisted the process of collectivization would just be called a kulak, or anybody who just happened to have a little bit of grain would be called a kulak. So anybody the regime didn't like, more or less, became known as a kulak and was subject to these terrible punishments. Everybody's property was ultimately turned over to the collective, turned over to the state. And that would include things like farm implements, for example, or livestock. All that would be turned over and everybody would be working for the government. Now, in particular, there was a part of the Soviet Union called Ukraine, that was not particularly keen on being part of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which was the full name of the Soviet Union under communism. They weren't particularly keen on being there. And Ukraine was also known as the breadbasket of Europe because it was so fertile. I mean, you could basically spit on the ground and an ear of corn would pop up. So Stalin, of course, wanted full control of the agricultural land there, and he didn't want to be at the mercy of Ukrainian peasants. And moreover, he didn't like the spirit of resistance in Ukraine. He didn't like the Ukrainian nationalism, the fact that the Ukrainians thought of themselves as Ukrainians first, and only a very, very distant second were they members of the Soviet Union. So Stalin wanted to really crush the Ukrainian resistance. So he killed two birds with one stone when engaging in agricultural collectivization in Ukraine. First, he gets hold of the agricultural land. He wants to do that. But in so doing, he also clears out and purges the Ukrainian intellectuals, Ukrainian poets, musicians, anybody who might have helped to cultivate a separate, distinct Ukrainian identity. This is the enemy of communism. National identity is an old-fashioned, backward idea from a long time ago. We don't have that anymore. You are going to be part of the Soviet Union, and you're going to quit this whole thing about being Ukrainian, and we're going to re-educate you to be Soviet citizens first and not think about your so-called Ukrainian heritage. So both of these steps are going to be taken at once, grabbing the agricultural land, collectivizing the land in Ukraine, and dealing a death blow to anybody who might be any type of cultural, political, or any other type of leader in Ukraine, so that the place would be completely helpless and ripe for the plucking by Stalin. In fact, Stalin's men were vicious in carrying out collectivization and in punishing so-called kulaks. Everybody became a kulak. And all your grain would be confiscated. Even grain you needed to live on was being taken away. And if they caught you hiding grain, well, forget about that. In fact, the best book on this, and you'll read this and it'll read like a novel. It's so interesting and compelling, but it's not a novel because it's real. And that book is Harvest of Sorrow by Robert Conquest. Harvest of Sorrow. I strongly urge you to read it. And I know you're thinking, oh, it's a history book. How could it be interesting? You read Harvest of Sorrow, then you come back to me and tell me that that was not an interesting book. It's going to blow you away what was done, the viciousness. And they quote people from the Soviet forces saying, we basically were told to forget all human sympathy, leave that aside. You've got to carry out your harsh and stern duty. And eventually, you're going to usher in a wonderful society. But unfortunately, in the short run, it means we have to engage in some fairly brutal tactics. Well, brutal they were. In fact, the result of this was at a time when grain storehouses on the border of Ukraine were bursting with grain, there was no grain for people to eat. And the result was a man-made famine in one of the most fertile agricultural areas of the world, Ukraine. And estimates range from somewhere between 5 and 6 million people who perished in this man-made famine. And I would venture to guess that maybe half of you watching this have never even heard of this atrocity. So many were the atrocities of the 20th century that people are not even aware of them. Eventually, by 1935, families were allowed to hold small private plots, averaging about 1 acre per family. And there they could grow their own vegetables and fruit, and they can sell those things at state-supervised markets. Now, it's interesting that by the time you get to the 1980s, about 2% of the Soviet agricultural land was these tiny plots. 2% was privately owned. And yet that 2% of Soviet land that was owned privately and not owned by the government produced 33% of all the food in the country. Hello? Think there might be a lesson here? In 1934, Stalin launches a series of purges whereby he gets rid of potential rivals by convicting them of crimes they did not commit. And later in the 1930s, this will be carried out even more systematically in what becomes known as the Great Terror, which was carried out both against the party elite, people who might be potential rivals to Stalin, but also against average citizens. Average citizens were being targeted. I mean, the idea of this was that if we only punished people who had clearly done something wrong, this wouldn't spread enough fear and terror into the public because you just say, well, I won't get involved in government matters, I won't comment on them, and I'll be safe. No, the idea was that we wanted people to be terrified, that no one would feel safe, that even if you did nothing, you could still find yourselves in trouble. This is how you carry out terror. So there was an old joke. Now, I'll warn you, it's not that funny. There's an old joke about two guys in Siberia, and one of them is asking the other one, well, what are you here for? I mean, because one of them was saying, well, I've been sentenced to 25 years. And the other guy says, wow, 25 years, what did you do? He said, I did nothing. And the other guy says, that can't be right. For nothing, you get 10 years. In other words, it was known to people that in fact, doing nothing could get you in trouble. All of a sudden, people would wake up and never see you again. This took place on a staggering scale. And indeed, there were cases of high officials in the Communist Party who were forced to admit to crimes they'd never committed, to having plotted treason against the great Soviet Union. And you wonder, why did they do that? Why didn't they just say, look, if you're going to kill me, just go ahead and kill me. I mean, don't make me go through this charade of confessing to crimes I didn't commit. And the answer was their families were threatened. If you don't confess to these crimes, then we're going to have to kill your family. So just an absolutely unspeakably horrifying situation. It also spread to the churches. Nearly all places of worship were closed. Over 165,000 churchmen were arrested for practicing their religion. Over 100,000 were shot. By 1937 and 1938, there were about 1,000 executions per day. By 1941, there were over 2.3 million people in slave labor camps. Between 1932 and 1939, the population of the Soviet Union declined by 9 to 10 million people. And when you consider that normally population should be rising, well, that figure becomes all the more startling. We have mass censorship throughout the society. Foreign travel was restricted to government officials. Of course, if anybody's allowed to go outside the country and see that the rest of the world is not an insane asylum like the Soviet Union, and that people don't live the way they're forced to live, that might give them ideas. So therefore, you're not allowed to travel. And incidentally, I did not choose the Soviet Union because this is an especially horrific example of how Marxism-Leninism has worked out in practice. This is just a very common example. But if you look at Marxism-Leninism in other countries, they all share the same principles. There's always one party to which unquestioning obedience is expected. Private property is abolished in the means of production. So in capital goods, factories, banks, whatever, all those things necessary to produce things, private property is no more. All human and material resources are nationalized, that is, put at the disposal of, well, they'll say the nation, but they really mean the government. And of course, needless to say, as should be quite obvious, we have here a complete disregard of individual rights, of the ideas that we talked about early on in this course. Here we see the exact opposite. No regard for such rights whatsoever. A lot of pretty language in the Soviet Constitution, but none of it meant anything. None of it was ever enforced or honored. So this gives you a sense of the lengths to which the state can go in the worst case scenario. So that's our week on Marxism and communism. Pretty gruesome, but you need to know about it. Thanks for watching.
All right, everybody, that's our episode for today. TomWoods.com/2161 is how you can find out how to get this course if you'd like it. There are 90 lessons in the course, so they will keep you busy. I want to mention that tomorrow we have on the show rather an unusual topic, but yet one that if we're going to be thorough here as libertarians, we have to cover. We know how screwed up the healthcare system is and that state insinuation into the system, into every nook and cranny, has an awful lot to do with why it's so screwed up. But I also want to talk about, and this is what we're going to do tomorrow, ambulance services. Even ambulance services are way, way worse than they would be otherwise for all kinds of reasons that we're going to discuss tomorrow. So I like people to be aware of ways in which the state has made your life worse, because unless you had this sort of insider's knowledge of how ambulance services work, you would have no way of knowing how government regulation is making it worse. You'd have no way of knowing. And yet we have so many people with so much specialized knowledge in their particular industry, knowing how their industry has been wrecked by the state, but any particular one of us isn't going to know about any particular industry. We might know general principles about how the state screws things up, but I'm bringing on somebody with nearly 20 years experience who has said to me, you know, I've kept my mouth shut so as not to make waves, but enough's enough here. This system is teetering on the verge of collapse, and somebody's going to talk about it. So it's going to be a fun episode. So make sure you tune in for tomorrow's episode, number 2162. And if you like and appreciate what Old Woods here does, check out supportinglisteners.com because boy, do you get lots of benefits because I deeply appreciate people who help me with this show. So supportinglisteners.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.